Blog Talk Radio.
I hate you both. I've hated you ever since I can remember. I hate you, and I wish you both had cancer.
Cancer?
Yes, in the head.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Are you telling me you built a time machine? Out of a DeLorean?
That's hot.
Hello there, children.
Hey, kids.
People seem to like me because I am polite and I'm rarely late.
And now the host of the Stupid Cancer Show, Matthew Zachary.
All righty. Monday, March 9th. And we are once again live on the Stupid Cancer Show, the voice of young adults with cancer. We are your friendly neighborhood weekly social webcast, finally giving voice to nearly 5 million young adults affected by cancer. This broadcast is a program of the I'm Too Young for This Cancer Foundation, a national leader in the fight against cancer, working exclusively on behalf of survivors and their care providers under the age of 40. Got cancer under 40? Sucks, huh? Well, get busy living because the Stupid Cancer Show is on the air. Welcome to tonight's broadcast. We are here to change the world one chemo infusion at a time and share all of our collective crapness. Now, call me a hippie, but do not call me a victim because I don't believe that change is possible if you never disrupt and challenge the status quo. I am still here, and you are still here. This is why we fight. Forget the cure, folks. That's right. You heard it here first. Forget the cure. Survivorship is all that matters. On last week's show, we had Pat Taylor, documentary filmmaker from Canada, producer and director of the film Chasing Rainbows, and also from Canada, which I didn't realize we had two Canadians on the show last week, young adult survivor of ALL, inspirational speaker and I2Y ambassador to Canada, Darren Neuberger. And tonight's show on clinical trials for young adults, starring our Survivor Spotlight, Hannah Volger from the Colon Club, Deborah Vollmer-Dahlke from the Texas Clinical Trials Network, and Ellen Coleman from Emerging Med, two really distinguished organizations in the clinical trials arena. Got a lot of great questions for them. So hello, my friends, and welcome you to yet another fun, fun, and exciting romp through the hay on tonight's Stupid Cancer Show. And a Stupid Cancer welcome to all of our first-time listeners here on the Blog Talk Radio Network, our new home on the Internet. Coming at you live from the Chemo Deck, our brand new studio in downtown Manhattan, I'm your host, Matthew Zachary, a 13-year young adult survivor of brain cancer. Joining me live in the studio tonight, our chief cancer anarchist, Jack Buffard. Hey, Jack.
Good evening, Matthew. How are you?
I'm doing great. And we have a live studio audience tonight, Jack. That's pretty awesome. Welcoming to the studio here, Jason Malott, Barry Malott, Erica Reyes, and Brooke Ballantyne. Small applause. Small round of applause for our studio audience. All right, here we go. Back to tears for fears. Anyway, Jack will be monitoring our live chat room, so if you have something to say, well, I might ignore you, he won't. But feel free to ignore him, as most people do, especially the women.
Fortunately, that is correct.
And with a new studio comes a new co-host, hailing from the windy city of Chicago and upgraded from the ranks of chief cancer oncospondent, the lovely and talented Carol Rosenthal. Good evening, Carol.
Hello, Matthew.
How you doing tonight?
I'm doing really well. How are you?
I am fabu.
Excellent.
So welcome to the Stupid Cancer Movement, because we're here to stay and the couch is comfy. You see, we're not just about the quantity of your life, we're about the quality too. Why? Because there's more to the cure than just research. For better or for worse, change comes slowly and only from within. The need to cure cancer for Gen X and Gen Yers, whatever that means, is only going to come from within our own ranks. Are we on our own? Well, I say that if we're the generation that invented Google and Facebook and Second Life and Camp Sanjaya and American Idol all those weeks, we should be able to take care of our own. This is Generation Cancer, and it's our fight. We have the sheer numbers, the voting power, and the influence to change the rules, because remission is not an excuse for a cure, and survivorship is all that matters. Are you in? Because the time is now. It's time, it's our time, and it's about time. Donna Martin graduates. And now the news.
Hello, I'm Kent Brockman, and this is Eye on Cancer.
Just the facts, ma'am.
All righty, during this part of the Stupid Cancer Show, we announce worthy news stories to our adoring listeners who inform them about the latest and greatest in young adult programs, services, events, projects, and other stuff. If you have an upcoming program, event, press release, or stuff that you'd like to hear broadcast during this segment, please fax it to us at 646-861-2565 or email Jack Buffard at jack@i2y.com. That's 646-861-2565 or jack@i2y.com. Take it away, Jack.
Thank you, Matthew. First things first, I'd like to wish a happy 65th birthday to my dad, Big Daddy Buffard. Congratulations on hitting 65, Dad. Now pick up your Medicare card and go enjoy your colonoscopy. Moving on to the stupid cancer news. The I'm Too Young for This Cancer Foundation and the Leukemia Lymphoma Society are proud to present the 2009 Oh My God Summit for Young Adults, Monday, May 4th in New York City. The Oh My God Summit provides attendees with valuable resources specific to the needs of young adult patients and survivors. Check out the OMG website at www.omgsummit.org. The pre-registration process is underway. We're already more than halfway to our capacity, so please register now. OMGSummit.org. We're limited to 175 attendees, so register now. Seattle, Washington. Are you looking for a support group to partake in? Well, put down your latte and pay attention, because the Leukemia Lymphoma Society is here to help. The Young Adult Support Group will meet on the third Monday of the month for the next 6 months, beginning Monday, March 16th. To pre-register for this free group, log on to www.lls.org/WA. Or you can contact Stacy Martin at stacy.martin@lls.org. Or you can reach Stacy at 206-957-4583. To my friends in Los Angeles, the UCLA Livestrong Survivorship Center of Excellence is proud to present their Cancer Survivor Education Day, Saturday, April 4th at the UCLA Cabo Commons. Join us as we discuss the latest research on survivorship issues and provide valuable information specific to the young adult cancer community. The $10 admission fee includes lunch and snacks, and for more information, head on over to tickets.ucla.edu. Hey, all you friends of... Check that, Matthew. Hey, all you fans of Tamika and Friends. Take a step against cervical cancer by voting for my friend, my BFF, Tamika Felder, young adult cervical cancer survivor, advocate, and friend of I2Y. Please visit i2y.com/Tamika. That's i2y.com/TAMIKA. To be redirected to a Facebook cause page where you can vote your heart out. Be sure to scroll down the page to the Lead Out Loud section to cast your vote for our friend Tamika. Attention Maryland, the Omid Cancer Fund for Young Adults is proud to present their Screw Cancer Happy Hour series. A Screw Cancer Happy Hour for Columbia, Maryland is being held March 18th. And for more information, visit omanfund.org. That's ulmanfund.org. Anyone drinking for the cure this coming St. Patrick's Day? Spend your happy hangover day with Stupid Cancer on SiriusXM Satellite Radio, Wednesday, March 18th from noon to 2 Eastern Standard Time. I2Y founder Matthew Zachary, Stupid Cancer Show co-host Carol Rosenthal, and your chief cancer anarchist, me, Jack Buffard, will be in studio on SiriusXM's Dr. Radio Oncology Show. Matthew, Carol, and I will be in studio discussing the young adult cancer movement while raising awareness to our age-specific needs with hosts Dr. Abe and Dr. Sylvia. Carol will be discussing her new book as well, and your calls and comments are welcome. You can find SiriusXM's Dr. Radio at www.sirius.com/Dr. Radio. Speaking of Carol's book, Matthew, Everything Changes, The Insider's Guide to Cancer in Your 20s and 30s is a book written by our very own Stupid Cancer co-host, Carol Rosenthal. From sex toys and assisted suicide to cobra and clubbing during chemo, Carol's new book, Everything Changes, dusts the sugar coating off of the young adult cancer experience, revealing ultra ultra-confessional cancer stories from 25 young patients and packed with unprecedented resources, Everything Changes has been hailed by Sex and the City's Evan Handler as the most forthright, emotionally sophisticated, and plain old valuable book of its kind. Everything Changes, The Insider's Guide to Cancer in Your 20s and 30s, is available wherever books are sold. To learn more, visit the blog everythingchangesbook.com. St. Louis, Missouri. Achieving Recovery from Cancer to Health Childhood Cancer Survivor Retreat Weekend is being held at the Perry Marquette Lodge in Grafton, Illinois. Friday, March 20th through Sunday, March 22nd. Young adult survivors 18 to 30 years old and who are 2 years removed from treatment may attend this free weekend. For more information and to apply, contact Lisa Matola at area code 314-454-4635 or email Lisa at lmm1321@bjc.org. Hey, Long Island, come to the first official Stupid Cancer Do Something fundraiser. Stupid Cancer Do Something is being held at Mulcahy's of Wantagh, 3232 Railroad Avenue in, believe it or not, Wantagh. The $45 entry fee not only helps support the Stupid Cancer movement, but gives attendees a great buffet dinner complete with open bar. Scholarships will be offered to survivors in treatment, and for more information regarding our inaugural Stupid Cancer Do Something event, head on over to events.i2y.com. Can't Make a Dreams Ovarian Cancer Retreat is being held April 30th through May 4th, and their Young Adult Survivor Retreat is May 13th through May 18th. Can't Make a Dreams retreats are held in fabulous Montana, and for more information, please refer to campdream.org or call Can't Make a Dream at 406-549-5987. Next up, we have 70k.org. That's the word 70, the letter K.org. There are approximately 70,000 people aged 15 to 39 diagnosed with cancer every year. For over two decades, there has been little or no improvement in survival for this age group. By signing this bill, you are supporting the Adolescent and Young Adult Cancer Bill of Rights to be established as a standard for care to meet the needs of this underserved population. Moving on to cancer care programs. The young adult groups that are active and running at cancer care are Living with Cancer, Inactive Treatment, Life After Cancer, Post-Treatment, Young Adults Loss of a Parent, Young Women with Breast Cancer, Young Adult Individual Grief Counseling, and Young Adult Caregiver for all diagnoses and relationships. Contact our friend Julie Larson at jlarson@cancercare.org. That's jlarson@cancercare.org. Or contact Julie by phone at 212-712-6173. Live On, sperm banking by mail for cancer patients. I've said it once and I've said it again. I'll say it again. Don't do what I did, guys. Mailing sperm without a Live On kit is frowned on by our federal government. For more information on sperm banking by mail, please go to www.liveonkit.com. My sperm banking by mail is made possible by our great friends at Fertile Hope, and I would personally, again, like to send out a big thank you to the law firm of Dewey, Scroom, and Howe for clearing up my embarrassing situation with the United States Postal Service. And finally, Matthew Zachary is pleased to announce, and I am pleased to announce on his behalf, that he is doing a live concert called An Evening with Matthew Zachary, piano concert, Saturday, April 11th at 7 p.m. Please join us for a very special one-night-only engagement as Matthew returns to the stage for his first public concert in nearly 10 years. There are only 100 tickets available. They are selling like hotcakes. I don't know how fast hotcakes go, but your tickets are selling like hotcakes. And for more information, you can go to MatthewZachary.com/NYC. Again, that's MatthewZachary.com/NYC. General seating is $20. VIP seats are $40. Tickets are going fast. Get them now. And that, my friends, is the Stupid Cancer News.
Alrighty, thank you, Jack Bouffard, for the Stupid Cancer News. Carol, you're with us.
I certainly am.
You've been busy, haven't you?
I've been a crazy busy blogging girl.
I love your crazy busy blogs.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I've been having a lot of fun and great conversations with people, particularly this week. Nudity and cancer. It's been a big one this week.
That sounds like a recipe for fabulousness.
Well, it does, unless you're the one who's like pinned down like a butterfly on the table and naked with a bunch of doctors standing around you. So it can go two ways.
I think you've just encouraged Jack to take his shirt off.
Well, okay, let's know what transpires.
Apparently it's not too hard. Oh, take that two ways. Sorry about that. Not good. We try to stay PG-13 here. That is not NC-17. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, come on. We're all over 17.
That's true. That is true. So we're going to talk about clinical trials tonight, and I love the fact that you do all this crazy, like, investigatory, and that's a Zoolander word, research, about what we're going to talk about. Did you find anything interestingly odd or suspicious or potentially bureaucratic or conspiratorial in any of your R&D leading up to tonight's guests?
Well, how can we not? I have some questions that I'm curious to ask our guests about that I don't know the answer to. You know, what's the difference when you're looking for a clinical trial and you're going through something online such as clinicaltrial.gov, which of course is government-supported, associated with the National Cancer Institute, versus working through another kind of organization, either a for-profit organization or an organization that is a nonprofit extension of a pharmaceutical company or a pharmaceutical lobbying company. So they're all different kinds of services that let us know about clinical trials, and I'm curious to know whether or not, as the patient who's being served, is there a difference in the kind of information that I get, how clinical trials are listed and presented? Is there a difference in that information whether I go to a government-supported site, a nonprofit organization, for-profit, or a nonprofit branch of a pharmaceutical company? So that was the big question that came to mind as I started doing some research.
Well, who better to start off our evening with than our first guest with our brand new guest cue music? And here we go. My first guest co-founded the Colon Club after her younger cousin Amanda Sherwood Roberts died at 27 from colon cancer. Unmute her here. The Colon Club is dedicated to educating younger people about colorectal cancer. Their project includes the Colossal Colon, a 40-foot-long crawl-through model of the human colon, the Colander, an annual calendar of young colorectal cancer survivors, and the Wipeout Colorectal Cancer Toilet Paper. Please welcome to the show returning champion and member of the Live Strong Young Adult Alliance, Hannah Vogler.
Thank you, Matthew.
Hello, Hannah.
Hey, Hannah.
How are you?
It's a pleasure to have you back on the show. Carol and I have been expecting you. And before we get into the clinical trials aspects of what we wanted to talk about, it is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Is that correct?
That's correct. It started on Sunday, technically.
And what does that actually involve? Because there's clearly no pink ribbons.
No, we, in fact, don't have the pink ribbons, although we do have a blue star, which is very nice. The entire colorectal cancer movement kind of came up with that a couple of years ago as a way to distinguish ourselves from all the other ribbons, because, you know, with colons, you got to be a little bit different. Awareness Month really is just like it is for any other cancer. It's a time when, yes, you can get colorectal cancer any day of the year, but this month we want to, you know, put a little extra light on colorectal cancer. And I want to say that 1999 was the first year that that Congress actually established March as National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, so it's actually fairly new.
And obviously, you know, the Colon Club is it largely geared towards younger people, or do you find that you attract some boomers and then kick them away?
Well, we don't kick anybody out. Although, yes, we're definitely mostly younger people, and that's how we set it up. Because my cousin Amanda was so young and my business partner Molly, who you also know, was diagnosed on her 23rd birthday, you know, they quickly found out that there were really not very little resources, but no resources for anyone who is young with colorectal cancer, not before you get diagnosed to try to help figure out what's going on with your body and help get diagnosed earlier, and also after they were diagnosed with any type of support, really even knowing that there was anybody else out there. And so, you know, that's something that we've tried to change. But we do have some young at hearters, is what we say. And
That's very diplomatic of you.
Well, some of our older people are super fun. So we really, you know, we don't want to leave anyone else out. We just hope that our approach will catch, you know, the younger ages and help educate them as well as sort of the more typical age or the more stereotypical age that people are thinking about.
Now, it's funny because clearly, you know, just to start from the top of the page, most people don't even realize that young adults get cancer, but let alone colon cancer, which is much more, I think, stigmatized as an old man's disease.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, there are 15,000 or so young adults under 50 diagnosed with colon cancer every year. One of the things about the young adult movement, which ties into tonight's theme, is that there's been no improvement in survival rates for young adults diagnosed with any cancer, largely due to the fact that there's a late diagnosis and that there's a lack of clinical trials for those young adults. To what extent are you guys raising awareness for the fact that it happens, and what are people to understand about how clinical trials factor into this complexity?
You know, you mentioned a couple of the projects that we do. I think the biggest message that we have for people is not, oh, gee, you're young, you should be scared of colorectal cancer, but like you said, this is not just an old man's disease. And it really is shocking how many times you hear that when really the pure numbers are quite enormous of younger people being diagnosed with colorectal cancer. And so we just try to gain a little bit of awareness that, hey, you know, if you have a family history, certainly, if you happen to be having any of these symptoms, hey, something's wrong. You know, you don't normally have symptoms of colon cancer. You shouldn't be excessively bloated and having abdominal pain. You know, you shouldn't be anemic or vomiting or having massive changes in your bowel habits. These are not normal things that go on. And so, you know, when people are experiencing those things, we're just hoping that they will have seen one of our campaigns and gone, hey, you know, I really should say, hey, doctor, you know, I'm not going away until we figure out what is wrong. And that they're getting a colonoscopy instead of just listening when somebody, you know, quote, I say diagnosis, but when you're diagnosed with IBS and nobody's ever looked up your butt, then frankly, they don't know. And so, you know, you got to do that. I think what you said about clinical trials and certainly with colorectal cancer, I think we're probably in a little bit of a better boat because there are so many trials for this particular disease. I mean, I think last time I looked on clinicaltrials.gov, I want to say that there were over 1,000 trials listed. Now, not every one of them was active, but there are hundreds and hundreds of trials for colorectal cancer that are active. But, like you said, the participation of young adults is so low. And my cousin Amanda actually did participate in a clinical trial for a drug that is now part of the basic regimen for colorectal cancer. So we see in our family just how important, like, her participation was 10 years ago, so that now people are actually living longer and being cured from the disease. So I think, you know, just getting the word out, number one, I think you could, in many cases, you can get better care. If you are involved in a clinical trial, you have access to drugs that you may not have access to otherwise, and you will at least be getting the standard of care that you would have been getting anyway. So there's not a huge downside for a lot of people. I think another challenge, though, for young adults especially is that most young adults are not treated at major cancer centers, and so their access to clinical trials is fairly limited. So that's kind of discouraging, but hopefully, you know, hopefully all of us can change that a little bit. It's discouraging to me even when I go to help someone look for a clinical trial, and even with all those hundreds of trials out there, there's not a single one that's geared towards young people. So, you know, that's a very discouraging thing that hopefully we can change.
Well said. And clearly lots of barriers facing every young adult, but especially when you're dealing with the rarities, you know, of colorectal cancer.
Mm-hmm.
These are short segments. We got about a minute and a half left, but I love everyone knows I live and breathe for the colossal colon, and it's like the coolest thing in history. And I've never actually seen it in person, but every picture I see, not a moment goes by with not someone laughing their ass off when they look at it.
Absolutely.
Tell our fabulous listening audience exactly what the colossal colon is and why it's to be loved by all.
Well, I'll tell you right now, if you really want to go see the colossal colon, it's actually today stuck at the Canadian border, so you have a chance to see it there in Port Huron, Michigan. It's sitting at the border. The colossal colon is the brainchild of my business partner, Molly. It's a 40-foot long, 4-foot in diameter, crawl-through colon. When you crawl through there, it starts all nice and all. You got some healthy colon tissue, the way things are supposed to look. Things disintegrate pretty quickly from there. You see some different non-cancerous diseases that still have many of the same symptoms of colorectal cancer, like Crohn's disease, diverticulosis, things like that. You see some polyps, and then by the end, you're seeing some super nasty cancer. And, of course, we couldn't help ourselves. We had to do some hemorrhoids at the end. So we've got this big colon. It travels all throughout the country and obviously in Canada, just to help people kind of open their eyes to this disease. And like you said, you know, this is one of the ones that maybe has a little bit more of a barrier because people don't want to talk about it. And that's the barrier that we're trying to break down with the colon. And it is amazing when people see it, oh, how can they not tell somebody what they just did? And then hopefully that's kind of opening the door to a bigger conversation about colorectal cancer and maybe them learning even just a little bit of information that they need to know in case they do have that family history or in case they do start experiencing symptoms.
I commend you, and I commend Molly, who eventually will be on this show, I would imagine.
You know, she really is done having babies, I promise.
Okay.
Molly's actually still on maternity leave for those.
She owes me two slots on this show at this point. Children
I'll
be damned.
Her.
All right. Well, thank you, Hannah. It's always a pleasure to have you on, and we look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you so much. You guys have a great show.
All right. Hannah Vogler, everybody, from colonclub.com. All righty. My second guest tonight, our second guest tonight, actually, is the founder and idea generator of the Texas Clinical Trial Network. Deborah Vollmer Dahlke is an accomplished entrepreneur, strategic marketer, and a published author with a background in oncology and oncology clinical trials. With tours of duty at McKinsey and Deloitte, as well as technology startups and cancer clinics, Deborah brings an entrepreneurial approach to her work in Texas and her new mission to expand recruitment, accelerate enrollment, and support communications for Texas clinical trials. Please welcome to the Stupid Cancer Show my friend and yours, Deborah Vollmer Dahlke. Am I pronouncing your name right, Deborah? I think I'm botching it up somehow.
You know, you're really close, Matthew. It's Deborah Vollmer Dahlke, and I think it sounded pretty good. So thank you, and thank you for having me on your show.
And for tolerating my New York accent, perhaps. Well, you've been listening, and it's a real honor to have you on the show, and it's been a long time coming. We're very excited to talk about clinical trials. As you might have heard before, Carol and I were running through the potentially calamitous universe of confliction in young adult clinical trials, and I know she has a laundry list of stuff to talk about. I'm looking forward to a really engaging conversation. So I'll turn it over to Carol, and I'll chime in as needed.
Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Carol.
So we have, you know, we're half an hour into the show, and we've probably said the word clinical trial 50 times already, but I think that there are a lot of unknowns about what a clinical trial actually is, and I'm wondering if we can kick off your segment with a little clinical trial 101, the Cliff Notes version, just explaining to listeners what some of the basic lingo is of a clinical trial, how people become enrolled, what they are.
Take a chance at 101. So here's a couple things to think about. So clinical trials are important because they're the only way that drugs or treatments get approved by the FDA and make it to the market and make it to us. So if you've taken an antibiotic, an antiemetic, had chemo, or just used sinus medicine, you're benefiting from the results of a clinical trial and the patients who participated. So trials are you know, a process. They're a research process. And they're done to consider the safety and efficacy. Efficacy meaning does it work? Data for a new drug, or it's not just drugs. It can be, you know, the process of treatment. It can be a medical device. It can be more than just a clinical trial. I mean, just taking a treatment drug. And the other thing to think about is, like, there's not just one kind of clinical trial. There's about seven. So there's prevention trials. There's screening trials that are, look at ways to detect cancer and other diseases. There's diagnostic trials that look at ways to diagnose cancer. And some of those are really cool right now because they're looking at genetic markers and things like that. So that's kind of a neat area. And then there's treatment trials, which a lot of us are really interested in because they're the ones that you know, test a new therapy against a standard of care. Standard of care means what you usually get. And then there's also quality of life or supportive cares that are kind of useful, especially for people who are survivors. There's also some called that are genetics and population-based, and they mostly look at blood or tissue samples, so they don't take much participation except you give up some part of your body for it.
They usually make you sign a little piece of paper letting you know beforehand.
Yes. So that one's, yeah, those are the easy ones. But and then the other way to think about it, so we've kind of gone through, well, there's all these different types of trials. And then there's different what we call phases of trials. So that's the different points in the research process that a trial or a drug or a treatment goes through. So there's like phase one trials, and that's the first time that a drug is tested in human subjects. And I worked in a phase one cancer clinic, and I always thought of the phase one patients as kind of like rocket pilots or jet test pilots because they're incredibly brave. I mean, they're the first time a drug is ever, you know, injected, swallowed, used by a human being. So, and those are usually pretty small. And they are really designed to assess the safety, the tolerance, kind of the way the drug works. So they're very small. They're usually maybe 8 to 20 people. So they're small. And they look at kind of the doses that patients get. Okay? And then there's and especially in cancer, the phase one trials are a little bit different because and sometimes they use healthy volunteers for phase one trials. But in cancer, it's often people who are kind of at the end stage and they've tried everything else and they lack other treatment options. That's why I think of them as test pilots.
I think it's really interesting to differentiate that because I think sometimes there's a misconception or a myth that clinical trials are only for people who are at the very end stage and nothing else has worked, and that's not necessarily true or true of all the different phases of a clinical trial.
You're absolutely right, Kelly. And actually what's interesting about that, especially these days with all the targeted therapies and molecular markers, molecular targets that are going into trial, especially for cancer, it sometimes means that if you join a phase two trial, and that's the second part, the second phase is phase two, you may be, you know, way ahead of everybody else in getting access to a drug, or it may be a situation, you know, if you have something like, you know, a really latter stage melanoma or pancreatic cancer. Melanoma AYAs are diagnosed with pancreatic cancer less, although sometimes, you know, under 40s. It means that you have access to a drug that you can't get if you aren't in a trial.
Huge, huge benefit.
Huge benefit. I mean, there's always risk and benefits. So phase two is phase one, they looked at the initial safety. Phase two is a larger group of people, anywhere from 20 to 300, and it really looks at how well the drug works, and it continues kind of the safety work that was done in phase one. But this is usually the point at which a drug either is figured out to work or its side effects are too much or it just doesn't work as well as the current standard of care. So it's really an important phase. Phase three studies, the next one is, it's where the trial participants become randomized. And it's usually conducted at lots of different centers. And it may be anywhere from 300 to 3,000 patients, depending on the drug and the trial design. But randomized, and people look at randomized, sometimes they go, whoops, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be randomized. I might get a sugar pill. Well, it's not going to happen with cancer. You'll either get the standard of care, the standard of care and the new drug, or the standard of care or the new drug. So they have different groups of randomization, but it's mostly the whole thing is kind of like phase three is the definitive assessment. Does this drug work compared with the current gold standard treatment? And these trials take a long time. So we talked about phase one, two, and three. You know, it can sometimes take, depending on how long it takes to get the patients, anywhere from, I think the average is about 7 or 8 years to get a trial to market.
Let's talk about how long an individual patient is on a trial. If somebody's considering a clinical trial, What's the average duration of time that a patient is on a clinical trial?
You know, it really varies. So it might be, it varies up on the phase of the trial. So phases one and two might be slightly shorter. Phase three will traditionally be longer, but not always. And it may be 3 months, it may be 6 months, it may be a year, maybe 2 years. It really, really just depends on the trial's design itself. So there's no easy answer to that one. Sorry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Before we move on to talking specifically about young adults, a moment ago you used the term risks and benefits. So give us a rundown. If you were to give an overview of what are the risks versus benefits of participating in a clinical trial.
I'm glad you asked that because a lot of us are advocates for clinical trials, but for the patient and the patient's family, you always want to be able to think and ask lots of questions about the risk and benefits. So the benefits are, one, you can take a more active role in your healthcare. You've looked at options, and we can talk sometimes if we go further about whether or not your doctor told you about clinical trials or referred you to one. But you're taking a more active role. Two, as we said before, you've got access to new, potentially beneficial treatments that aren't available to the public. Three, you frequently receive a higher standard of medical care and follow-up because trials are conducted by researchers who are passionately focused on that one disease. And they are experts in their field. And they're often, but not always, at academic and research facilities. So you get what's often considered a higher standard of care. And then the last bit is that, which is really a big deal to patients, is knowing that you're helping others by contributing to research. That said, there are risks. So the risks are, you know, a trial is research. It's done to figure stuff out. So there may be side effects or adverse reactions to the drug or to the treatment nobody knows about it. That's why it's a trial. So you're taking a risk there to some side effects. Two, the treatment might not work for you. So if you've entered into a treatment for a new therapy, potentially you could have been taking the standard of care. It might have worked better. There's no way of telling. And the other one is just your time and energy, because participation in a trial may not be in your community with your doctor. So it may mean, you have to travel a ways. You may have to travel a long ways. You may have to stay at that trial site for 2 or 3 days or longer. Sometimes you have to have more scans and more tests and things, so they poke you with needles more. So those are the risks.
Talk a little bit about this population specifically who's listening to us now, adolescents and young adults. And how are we different when it comes to clinical trials? I know that there's a statistic out there that 60% of pediatric cancer patients participate in clinical trials. But when you look at our age group that's slightly older, the 15 to 39-year-olds, the 20s and 30s, our participation drops down to somewhere between 1 to 2%. Why is that?
Well, it's probably not for any one reason, but you're right that, participation for young kids, those younger than 15, is 55 to 65%. Then it starts trending down, like about 25 to 35% of 15 to 19-year-olds are seen at institutions, but only 10% of them enter into clinical trials. And then we get down to maybe 1% of 20 to 29-year-olds that participate. So, yeah, it trends down. And, the reasons are not clear. It may be because, especially for young people, their lives are busy. They may be, one, the really youngers, like the 15 to 19-year-olds, they're still growing. Anyone who is anywhere from childhood, that middle group from 15 to 25 may be involved in education. So they've got classes. They're trying to, survive through their cancer and the treatments and go to classes and everything else. So that's an issue. The other thing is, especially in the 25 to 40-year-old group, young families, new jobs, period. All those things can conflict and compete with participating in a trial. So there are lots of reasons that younger patients don't get involved in trials. And maybe nobody asked them. That's the other thing, and that's the huge, awful question, is What if they don't know that they have options? What if no one tells them? And that's the scary part.
Yeah, it's a really big point of advocacy that we as young adults really need to grill our doctors and be proactive and ask them about participating in clinical trials. And few, if any, are available that are targeted specifically to our age range. Usually it's young adults that are participating in trials that are, you know, the age range of 18 to 65. So we might be the young ones amongst the gray hair ARP patients. And who knows if our bodies are biologically responding the same or not.
Well, and that's a big deal. But first of all, you know, it has, you know, the advocacy of Matt and my friend Heidi from Cancer Planet and others. Advocacy is working. I just looked on clinicaltrials.gov, and there are 236 studies for cancer in young adults. So while there used to be none,
mm-hmm.
and while many of these are supportive care trials, not all of them are. Some of them are real treatment trials with real drugs that are specifically targeted at, you know, ages 18 to 25 or 15 to 30.
Talk
so
real quickly about, yeah, you just mentioned clinicaltrials.gov,
mm-hmm.
and talk a little bit about the difference between various organizations that provide information about clinical trials. So we have governmental organizations like the National Cancer Institute, we have nonprofit organizations, and then there are organizations, correct me if I'm wrong, like your nonprofit organization, which is a nonprofit branch of a for-profit biotech and pharmaceutical company.
We're actually a nonprofit of a nonprofit.
Uh-huh.
So our parent organization is the Texas Healthcare and Bioscience Institute, and they're an industry association.
So they lobby
also,
they tend to lobby for
right. They lobby
companies.
For academic medical centers, for pharma and biotech and all kinds of people.
So as a patient, how, when I'm interfacing with a clinical trial, is there a difference between me going through somebody who might be part of an organization that's lobbying on behalf of pharma versus a governmental organization or a nonprofit organization?
Well, I think the first thing that's most important is, one, is if you're looking for, if you are a young adult or the parent of a young adult looking for a trial, what happens is if you go to clinicaltrials.gov, remember I just found 236 studies for cancer in young adults,
mm-hmm.
there is no way that a young adult or their parent, and frequently often their doctors or nurses, is going to be able to go through that huge list of trials and find a trial that is perhaps, or a couple of trials, that's a good match for that particular person.
So they don't have any method of sorting when you get to that
they
website?
You can sort by city and state, but you know
mm-hmm.
what? You want to go where it's best for you, not maybe, you know. I mean, you may want to go where it's local. It's good to go local, but you may find that there's a trial. You may live in Texas and find there's a trial in New York that's really the trial that you want to participate in.
And how
so
do...
it's hard to search
mm-hmm.
that way.
Okay.
So you talk about so that's...
Just...
That's
sorry,
government.
I just want to chime in real quick that we have to go to Ellen, but if there's any sort of final comments for a minute left, I know she's been on hold waiting very patiently.
So Ellen can finish this question. So the last comment I have to make is that it's one thing to match to a trial, but what I believe that patients, young, old, children, whoever, young, you know, rich, poor, doesn't matter, people need help educating and navigating to clinical trials. They need somebody to talk to and kind of walk them through the process and be their champion. And that's what we're trying to do in Texas. We're trying to create a matching service, but we're bringing into this patient navigators who are culturally appropriate. So that may be young people, maybe old people, maybe ethnic people. It's just someone who can talk to you on your level about things you care about. So that's what we're doing in Texas. And with that, Matthew, thank you. It's a joy to be on your show.
No,
Karen,
we want to have
too.
You back. Clearly, you know, Carol and I, we spoke long and hard about this. We could dedicate an entire week to this very topic. It's just so critical, and I have a million other questions that hopefully we'll get Ellen to talk about. But you guys are a great tag team for our show tonight. We definitely want to have you back.
Thank you again.
Thank you very much. Carol, thanks for all those great questions. Deborah Vollmer-Dahlke from the Texas Clinical Trial Network. And now,
what time is it?
All right, our second guest tonight is a very patient guest waiting in the wings, Executive Vice President of Emerging Med
She brings considerable experience working with patients with life-threatening illnesses. Prior to joining Emerging Med, she was the Associate Executive Director for Cancer Care, one of our favorite organizations. She's also published and presented frequently on the psychosocial aspects of life-threatening illnesses, including two book chapters. Please welcome to the Stupid Cancer Show, Ellen Coleman. Hello, Ellen.
Hello, Matthew.
I know you've been listening.
Great, I haven't had applause like that in a long time.
Well, you deserve it. You deserve it. Carol and I, you've been listening the whole time. You know this is an incredibly important and engaging conversation to have. We have a lot of listeners here who are waiting with bated breath to understand what exactly a clinical trial was, and just amazing conversations and dialogue tonight. I have a quick question for you. I know Carol has some questions as well.
Sure.
But do you have anything specific to follow up with what Deborah was talking about?
Well, I didn't hear all of what Deborah was saying. I probably missed the first few minutes, but she really did set the stage. And at the end of what she was talking about was access to clinical trials. And that is the most important piece for people to know that they exist. And that's really what Emerging Med is all about, is really about increasing clinical trial education and access with a personalized service. And Deborah did really stress that at the end, that people really need help walking through this. This is a complex situation. It's not like going to the drugstore and buying an aspirin. I mean, it is a lot of detailed information that's difficult sometimes to understand, and I'm hoping we can get into a little bit deeper about that tonight as we talk, because I think it's enormously an important subject and important for people to learn as much as they can about it.
So not if I can jump in, not only is there the question of how do I decide which clinical trial I might be able to participate in, but how do I even decide what service or what entity can help guide me there? So talk a little bit about how people can shop around and the pros and cons of using different sorts of services, what they can get,
sure,
and what sort of help they can expect.
Sure. Well, you started to talk a little bit about the government databases, and Deborah was talking about searching through clinicaltrials.gov, which is obviously a great resource. It has lots of trials in there. The difficulty is the listing service.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference between that and a service like Emerging Meds, which is, I think, is quite unique, and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to join Emerging Med, is that Emerging Med works on a couple of fronts. It helps people access trials that are right for them. If you come into the Emerging Med process, which you can do so through, I know Matthew has the link on his website, but you can come through a number of different partners. And what we do with you is you get assigned a clinical trial specialist who walks you through a profile, which is really a set of questions based on your particular diagnosis and treatment history and staging. And we walk you through those questions, and then we match you to the database of trials and come up with a refined list. So out of that 236 trials that Deborah mentioned, we'll bring that down to a manageable list for you. And once we get that list, we'll go over with you the information about what kinds of treatments you might be looking for, where would you like to go, do you have any restrictions on geography, and then we'll get those trials into your hands. You can take those to your doctor and have a discussion, or you can call the trial sites directly. Part of the service is to, first of all, help you understand a lot more about clinical trials, what they are, and Deborah did a beautiful explanation of clinical trials. That's the kind of conversation we have with patients all the time, is explaining those phases, explaining a little bit about the risks and benefits, and really focusing it on a very personal experience. Why are you searching for trials today? What is it that led you to make this decision, and try to walk you through it? Once patients have those trials in hand and talk to their doctors or call the trial sites, the other thing that we do is we follow up with patients and really provide them, as long as they'd like, a service of making sure that they are looking at those options anytime a treatment decision is made. I think one of the things I heard Deborah say was that most people don't understand that you can search for clinical trials throughout the course of disease, and I think that's a really important point that I certainly want to get across, is that clinical trials options, you should look at clinical trial options whenever you're looking for, whenever you're making a new treatment decision. So, for example, you can do that prior to surgery, just after surgery, before you think about whether there's an adjuvant or treatment that is good for you after surgery, if your treatment isn't working, if your cancer recurs. So at all those different points in time, it's important to understand what your options are. And
Ellen, let me ask you a quick question here.
Sure, Matt.
A lot of the logistics that we've been discussing with you and Deborah tonight have been centered around the institution. We've spoken about this numerous times. There's nothing out there that puts the power of the trend influence or the power of recognizing, understanding, and sharing clinical trial information and context within the consumer realm. It's almost like you have to be dependent on knowing to go to the institutions for them to be able to have the information that you need to take back to your providers.
Mm.
And that this is a huge barrier for people in an age where we are becoming less dependent on the legitimacy of peer review and more dependent on the anecdotal natures of social networking.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any value to considering taking the clinical trial world into the social media realm and allowing, however anecdotally and perhaps imperfect, a system that it could provide more access and understanding to the whole process?
Well, I think you make a good point, Matthew, and I think we do have to be looking at much more creative ways. And as Deborah alluded to, you know, there's lots of barriers. There's not one easy answer. But I do think that we know for a fact that if people know about clinical trials, they're interested in knowing more and they're interested in considering enrolling. So the first step here is to make sure that people are aware of trials and have good information. And one of the hardest things is to make sure that people really get the right information. So these methods that you're talking about, I think, first of all, can be enormously helpful to making sure that the myths are busted, that there's some real reality out there about what clinical trials are, why it might be appropriate for a patient to be looking at a trial at any point in time. And so I do think that getting that information and that dialogue going in the way that social networking is going would be really important. I think that there's also a lot of room for patients who have participated in trial to share their experiences in a way that I think would be enormously useful to people who are in that situation of looking at treatment decisions. What do I do? You know, what's the right choice for me to make? And having people share their experiences, I think, is very powerful. And I think those kinds of new technologies and the new ways that people are networking, I think, are really important in trying to move that bar.
I know that, you know, approaching any aspect of cancer care as a young adult can be utterly overwhelming for a multitude of reasons. And I can imagine myself being incredibly interested in a clinical trial. I have a kind of cancer that does not respond to my treatment and at the moment is incurable. And I'd love to learn more about clinical trials. And on the other hand, my God, I'm just overloaded with cancer care and work and other kinds of life. Are there people in our lives who can do this for us? Are you able to have these conversations on the phone with our partners or our parents or our friends? Or is there like a HIPAA issue around that? Are you able to discuss and do matches for clinical trials with people who might call on our behalf to make it easier for us?
Sure. It's a really good point. And actually, we talk to a lot of caregivers and a lot of family members. And the issue is in terms of privacy, that if I'm talking to your sister and your sister has all of your information, I don't need to know your name. I don't need to even know your sister's name. All I need to know is the particulars about your particular cancer and the information that you want to know and to understand your level of education and even your sister's level of education to provide that service. So you make a very good point, and we get lots of people calling us who are the relatives of a person with cancer who are really, it's a great way, you know, people, you know, caregivers and friends are often saying, what can I do to help? I'd say that that's a terrific way for people to help. Say, you know, here's my information about my cancer. Go search for a trial with me. Go call, you know, call Emerging Med through one of the partners and find out what trials might be good for me. And we can definitely work in that realm. And we will never call, like if someone calls and says, you know, send these trials to my brother, we would never do that. We'll always be dealing strictly with the person that we're calling, so we're very concerned about making sure that the privacy is intact. But we definitely can work with a relative or a friend. And the other thing we can do is if the friend doesn't know as much about the cancer, we can email the questionnaire to that friend or family member, and then that person can sit with the person with cancer and say, hey, I got to ask you a few questions here. It won't take long, take 5-10 minutes, but that way, that's another way that the person can actually get that information and then get that back to us.
Do you ever find instances where maybe a patient is not currently receiving care at a university hospital or a teaching institution? They want to participate in a clinical trial. They use your service. They find out about ones that they might qualify for. They're very gung-ho about it, and they bring it to their doctor, and their doctor's not that big of an advocate of clinical trials or won't necessarily go the extra mile to help them figure out. Do you ever find that situation?
Yes, unfortunately, that, you know, we do find that that does happen quite a bit. The first thing I would say is that we know that I think the percentage is somewhere around 80%, it could be even higher, of most people with cancer are treated in the community setting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really not very, you know, the small percentage of people are going to these big cancer centers and big centers, academic centers. So most people are in the community. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of issues involved. One is our healthcare system. You know, our healthcare system does not readily encourage people to go from one doctor to another. Insurance doesn't always pay for that. Doctors don't want to lose their patients because that's, you know, their livelihood. Patients don't want to leave their doctors because they have been with that doctor for a while. So there's lots of things in terms of that relationship that don't really set it up as one that is encouraging sometimes.
Are you able to provide counseling to patients about how to work with those obstacles that you just mentioned, how to navigate those barriers?
That's definitely a big part of what we do, Carol, is we really try to talk to the patient. First of all, when we're talking to someone about clinical trials, we want to find out, are they going to take this information to their doctor? And if so, what kinds of things, how is that relationship? Do they often feel comfortable talking to their doctor, bringing them new information and questions, or is that a more challenging relationship? And so we will help them navigate those kinds of things. We will try to help them create a list of questions or the right way to bring trials in. I mean, doctors are humans too, and if somebody comes in and says, hey, you know, this is what I think I had to do, is different than coming in with a set of questions that might be more open to discussion rather than kind of ultimatum. So we really do work with patients about how to have these conversations because they are enormously important conversations for people to have, and they're not easy, particularly when...
What about issues of patient rights? So the opposite extreme of a doctor who's very gung-ho about a patient participating in a trial, and maybe they don't want to. I interviewed a woman in Alabama in my book, and she was extremely close to her doctor, and the doctor was really willing to her to participate in a clinical trial, and she researched it thoroughly. She knew a lot about it, and she just didn't feel it was right for her. But she felt a lot of pressure from this doctor who she was very close to participate. Why do those kinds of situations exist, and what are patients' rights in those kinds of situations?
Well, it's a very good question. First of all, patients absolutely have the right to refuse a clinical trial or refuse any kind of care. What we want to make sure is that they're doing that, you know, in an informed way. And it sounds like this person that you're describing had informed herself about this. And so I can't necessarily speak to the particular situation,
mm-hmm.
but we always make it enormously clear to patients that this is their choice. It is absolutely their choice to go into a trial or to not go into a trial. Even once you start a trial, if you want to stop it in the middle, you can do that. Obviously, that's not the best possible of all worlds, but it is always the patient's choice, and patients should be very clear about that, no matter what, you know, whether the doctor is saying no or whether the doctor is saying yes, that these are choices do lie in the hands of the patient. And I think you have to people have to learn to deal with facts rather than emotions. If you feel attached to your doctor and the doctor's pushing something, that's not a good reason. The best reason to do it is because you and your doctor have looked at the facts, and the facts show that this might be a good option for you. So that's, I think, really important.
You know, we only have a couple of minutes left, and I'm wondering if there are any other, I mean, we could go on for hours having this great conversation. Are there any burning last thoughts that you want to leave our patients with as we wrap up our listeners who are patients?
I think that, you know, just really the importance of being an informed decision maker, Carol. And when we talk to patients, I've listened to some calls and taken some calls. Most of the time what I find is that I don't think people are educated enough about the situation to be informed participants in their own decision-making process for treatments or for clinical trials. So I just really encourage people to take advantages of the resources that are out there, certainly our service is one of them, to make sure they know how to make the right decisions.
So important. My motto is think, question, and shout when you need to.
I like that very much.
Yeah, to be a really active participant. Matthew, any questions as we wrap up?
And I've been interestingly quiet during this. I'm just so fascinated by the conversation. I mean, I could have asked similar questions, but you're just so artisan-like in your dialogue about it. I think we need to figure out a way to make clinical trials hip and relevant and recognized in the sense that it's an asset. It's not something people should fear. And clearly we live in an age, and, you know, I'm the social media wonk in the family here. There has to be a way to bring it to the consumer masses in a more digestible, easy, and lazy way that ultimately will benefit people that don't know it exists. It'll educate doctors that don't know about it, and it'll bring a whole new continuum of patients into the system, and that can only benefit others down the road.
Totally agree with that, Matthew. Absolutely.
And, you know, a great way to for people to dive into that who are listening right now is if you have been a participant in the clinical trial and you are on Planet Cancer or you're on My Everything Changes blog or some other young adult cancer blog, blog about your experiences, because that is one way that we can learn from each other and educate each other.
Well said. Well said. Thank you, Ellen. This was a long time coming. We'd love to have you and Deborah back as returning champions. Clearly a conversation to be continued.
I'd love to do it. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Ellen. Ellen Coleman, everybody. All righty. Carol, good show. Lots of stuff to talk about.
Yeah, I'm ready and raring to go. Clinical trials.
I know. It's like I want to be on one. No, I'm kidding. I don't want to be on one. But
I do. You know, maybe this is an idea for, a reality TV show. Carol's
placebo clinical trial fantasy island. There we go.
Well, I mean, I kind of want to get off the phone and call Emerging Med right now and sort of find out what clinical trials are available for young adults with refractory papillary thyroid carcinoma.
God bless you, Gesundheit.
Thank you.
Well, I look forward to having you back next week. You have yourself a blast, and we'll see you here. Take care, Carol. Be well.
Adios, Matthew.
All right, and now it's time for our closing sequence.
Prepare to activate.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
You ever seen a grown man naked?
And so, to all of you, a fond farewell.
Hooray, I'm helping.
You are a meathead.
Oh, Magoo, you've done it again.
That was so terrible, I think you gave me cancer.
All right, folks, that's tonight's show. I hope you had as much fun as I did poking a stick at stupid cancer.
Love.
I'd like to thank my guests, Hannah Vogler, Deborah Vollmer-Dahlke, and Ellen Coleman. Fairly alliterative. Next week, Ajam Ali from the Survivor Celebration Group, founder of Survivor Celebration, and Fran Kondrak, young adult cancer patient advocate and co-founder of the organization What Friends Do. Sure to be one hell of a show. Same bat time, same bat channel. Folks, remember, if you missed any of our previous shows, you can listen to the archives at stupidcancer.com or subscribe to our podcast by listening to itunes.ituy.com or just search for Stupid Cancer within the iTunes store. Remember, if it's not stupid, it's not cancer. We'll see you all back here next week, live from the chemo deck. Jack, Carol, Captain Stubby, and I wish you all a phenomenal evening. Go to bed, Leah. Fokker out.
And love won't hurt anymore. It's an open smile on a friendly shore. It's love. Welcome aboard. It's love.
Testing, testing. No, it's the mic. Testing. No, it still sounds terrible.
Every week we
testing.
Yeah.